this lecture and the next lecture are both going to focus on the organizations of collective action in class struggle. But we're going to focus on them in different ways. So we are concerned here, in both lectures, we're concerned with the problem of class formation. Just to remind you at the most abstract level, class formation is the problem of how individuals as incumbents of structural positions become organized as collective actors within class struggles. And collective actor means a variety of things, but one of the things it means is as organized actors. It's a whole other topic which we really won't get into, exactly what the word organization means in this case. We often think of organizations as extremely well-defined, bounded entities, you know, structures of social relations. So you are a member of an organization. You join it. There's an act which puts you inside rather than outside. You join a union. You either join a political party and are a member of that association, or you vote for it without joining. But in either case, words like party and union have this very bounded character to them. Class formations need not only take that kind of form, that is a crucial form, but social networks of reciprocating coordinated activity can also be forms of class formation. What we call social movements have that character. Social movements contain organizations. There are indeed some organizations within social movements, but the notion of social movement is not a well-bounded notion. If we talk about the civil rights movement, we don't want to restrict it to the NAACP and other associations that you joined or didn't join. The notion of the civil rights movement includes a whole set of loosely structured networks that drew individuals into predictable interactions and reciprocities of coordinated action without there being sharp boundaries and clear insiders and outsiders. Nevertheless, what I'm going to focus on here are more of the organized forms of collective action, since they, whatever else is true, they certainly do play an important role. The division of labor between this part of the lecture, well, lecture 13, and what we'll be discussing on Wednesday, is in this lecture I'm primarily concerned with the internal operations within organizations, and in the next lecture we'll talk about the relationship between associations, if you will. The next lecture is going to focus on the concept of class compromise as a way of understanding how working class organizations, unions, and parties form particular kinds of relations to dominant class, capitalist class organizations of various sorts. And we're going to examine a particular idea in thinking about that relationship. That is the idea of class compromise as a stable kind of relationship between working class formations and capitalist class formations. Here we're going to look at the internal problems of organization itself. Klaus Offa and Helmut Wiesenthal wrote a very interesting piece in the 1970s called Two Logics of Collective Action. It's one of the pieces from my early formation, you know, when I was both a student and a beginning assistant professor, that was the most influential to me in terms of, well, you know, when I read it, I said, aha, that seems really interesting. I've learned something new. This gives me a whole different way of thinking about certain sets of problems. So I keep assigning it, even though there may indeed be better pieces on this particular problem now. I haven't tracked this particular kind of literature very well. I found this extraordinarily insightful. Klaus is a German sociologist. He's in his early 70s now. He's a student of Habermas, one of Habermas's earliest students. So Habermas is, I suppose, now mid-80s, probably. and Klaus's early 70s. When I was a graduate student in 1973, he came to Berkeley for a year as a visiting professor, and I took a couple of courses. And I can say unequivocally that the only courses I took as a graduate student from which I really learned something, it learned something in the sense of learned something that is unequivocally attributable to my interactions with the professor and what he had to say, not merely stuff I read, was the work I did with Klaus while he was there. I mean, for me it was absolutely fantastic. He was just this completely wonderful person to interact with at the time. The term paper I wrote for his class, is the last chapter of Class Crisis in the State. It was a comparison of Weber and Lenin's views on parliamentary democracy. Lenin's is very famous in the State in Revolution. Weber wrote a piece on parliamentary democracy that was a piece he wrote towards the end of the First World War about the problems that Germany would face in creating a stable parliamentary democracy after the war. And I wrote this paper on bureaucracy and democracy and Lenin and Weber. And Klaus liked the paper a lot. He gave me comments. But then he gave me one particular comment. So, you know, it happens that you get a comment from a professor that you remember forever, and that kind of then really made a difference for me. And the comment he said was, you know, this is all very interesting. You're very good at finding interesting things to say about other people's work. But what I really find interesting are the things you just have to say about the world. Why don't you spend less time trying to write about what other people think and just write about what you think? Now, that was a kind of liberation for me. So it happened at a key point in my graduate career. It was early enough on to really affect what I subsequently did, my second year of graduate school. You know, it was kind of giving me permission to write about contradictory class locations and about real utopias and, you know, all the things that I've worked on without constantly doing it in the form of a commentary on other people's work. And so it was giving me a permission to be a theorist, as it were, in my own right, constructing social theory rather than a commentator on theory. Sociology, in terms of its own intellectual traditions, has a very strong tradition of people doing sociological theory via their commentaries on other people's theories. Now that's, when you look at the journal Sociological Theory, most of the papers published in sociological theory have the character of careful and often interesting commentary on Foucault or on Durkheim or on Weber and Durkheim. Pairs of theorists are a compare and contrast exercises. It's this, people write papers that are kind of the same way they write prelim questions, on exams. So a theory prelim will have compare and contrast that you've thought of. You've all had exams of that character. What Klaus was telling me was that's all well and good. You can learn a lot from that. But really, if you're really serious about these things, what you got to do is just develop your own theoretical ideas, argue for them, develop their ramifications, and of course connect them to other people's work, but not have that be the primary idiom through which you develop your own work. And I took that as a kind of epiphany. That was just the best possible thing he could have said to me. It's sort of what I wanted to do anyway, but it liberated me from, if you will, the shackles of having to constantly do exegetical, textual analysis of other people's work as the way to develop theory yourself. There are some books that I've read subsequently to that, and therefore I'm kind of tuned into this issue. So there's a very good book on the concept of civil society by Andrew Arado and Gene Cohen, which I find both terrific and absolutely infuriating, because although they have very distinctive views on this problem, how do we think about civil society, the whole book is just endlessly parsing different theorists' views about civil society as a way of explaining their views. And it's an 800-page, this massive, heavy book. And you really have to work hard reading it to distill what their stand is, because they don't have a consolidated, here's how to think about civil society, damn it. This is the best way to go about it as far as we can tell. They don't lay that out. If they did that in some nice consolidated way, and then they said, now we're going to look at 200 years from Kant through Hegel and Talcott Parsons to Foucault. I mean, they discuss everybody and see how they did it. You know, there it would be, to me, it would be a much more satisfying book. So, okay, that's another little detour. That was about Klaus Offe and why I'm very fond of him, of course. We've tried, he has a bad back, so he claims that he only comes to give talks if the people inviting him will pay for a first class or business class international flight. And so we haven't been able to have him at the Haven Center. He came very early in the 80s, but we haven't had him back much as I would like him to, because he's always interesting, because we can't afford a $10,000 transatlantic flight for him. I don't know if that's just an excuse on his part or whatever. All right, so Offe is concerned with the problem. Here's the problem, straightforward problem. Working class struggles require organization. You know, you're not going to get sustained struggles of the sort that have any transformative capacity unless people form associations that have a stability to them. You have to have organizations. These organizations, however, create unintended consequences for the nature of struggle. They're not simply neutral instruments by which interests get translated into action. Organizations have internal structure, and these internal structures of organizations create deep dilemmas. What Offe argues is that the tendency for the organizations of class formation to, in developed capitalist countries, to invariably behave in ways that left-wing critics call opportunist or reformist, that tendency, is the result of these internally generated dilemmas of organization. They're the result of the distinctive logic of collective action that the collective associations of working class associations face. To clarify that, Offe proposes, I say Offe in this lecture, in my notes I'm careful to always say Offe and Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal is a student of Offe's. He insists that this paper is a fully, I'm sure it was fully collaborative, but the ideas in it are so continuous with Offe's work before and after that to me it's really Offe's intellectual product. I don't know Helmut Wiesenthal, I haven't met him, so I may be doing an injustice by not fully attributing the ideas to Wiesenthal as well. I tend to slide in talking about it to talking about Offe's contribution. So he's seeing reformism or opportunism as a strong tendency that emerges out of the internal organizational dilemmas of class formation. On Wednesday, we'll see how Szaborski argues that reformism or opportunism, I'll make a comment on the terms in a moment. He wants to argue that it comes out of the dilemmas of the relationship between class formations, that is, in the interaction between working class and bourgeois capitalist class formations. So Szaborski's argument is about the consequences for any given collective organization of its interactions with opposing organizations, whereas Offe is concerned with its internal organization. These are not necessarily opposed explanations. They're looking at different kinds of mechanisms that are in play. First, I want to just explain the name that I invoked for Wednesday, Szaworski. It's a Polish name with a silent P at the beginning. So in ordinary English, we have lots of words like that. Psychology has a P at the beginning. In Polish, there's this consonant cluster at the beginning of some words, P-R-Z. And people who haven't heard his name uttered go through contortions to try to get all of those consonants out. If it was just S-H, it would be fine. Szaworski. There's actually, I think, a slight nuance. It's sort of Szaworski. There's sort of an unvoiced P at the beginning, Szaworski, that you don't really hear, but you sort of, maybe it's there. Szaworski. Now, opportunism. Opportunism is a pejorative word. It's a word used by leftist critics of leadership of organizations. It's a way of denouncing them. You're being opportunist. Now, in one sense, of course, the word comes from opportunity. And the idea that you're taking advantage of opportunities, I mean, that could be a good thing. To be opportunist is to be really sensitive to what are the opportunities and taking advantage of them. The implication in the use of it as a pejorative label for leadership is that they're taking advantage of opportunities for their own advantage, not for the collective advantage of the organization they're serving. He uses the term opportunism in a non-pejorative sense. That is, in his discussion, he's trying to make this a technical term to describe a particular way that organizations function. An opportunistic organization is not necessarily one filled with corrupt leaders. It might be. And one might want to argue, even within Offie's analysis, that the kind of opportunism he is talking about opens the door for that kind of corruption. But he's not primarily concerned with personal corrupt behavior of of bad faith leaders. That's not his main concern. He defines opportunism by three primary attributes. This is on page 2 of the notes. An inversion of means over ends, in which the maintenance of the organization has higher priority than the pursuit of the goals of the organization. So a classic example is when a union worries more about what to do to preserve the union than what to do to have the union grow and be able to effectively struggle for its goals. Now, that's always in the name of the latter. That is, when you invert means over ends, when the means have priority over the ends, people always say, well, the reason for that is because unless the union survives, we can't struggle for these goals. And there's no reason to believe that that's dishonest in general, because it is also true. That's part of Offie's point. It is also true that protecting the organization is an important part of protecting the capacity to struggle for those goals. But the inversion of means over ends basically means that the ends retreat from the active consideration in the strategies of the organization. And the strategies become primarily focused on reproduction of the organization itself. That's the first point, inversion of means over ends. The second is preoccupation with short-term gains and losses rather than long-term possibilities. An organization concerned with long-term possibilities will always be willing to entertain context of the form, one step back, two steps forward. That is, we'll do things now which may hurt us because in the long run it will help us. Now, of course, that's a tricky kind of strategy because the future is uncertain. Doing things now that might hurt you because in the long run they might help you, it could be that the long run changes and all you've done is hurt yourself. That's why it's always tempting to worry about short-term gains and losses rather than long-term. But what he means by opportunism, then, is basically dismissing the long-term. The short-term always triumphs over the long-term. An opportunistic organization inverts means and ends and is always preoccupied with short-term rather than long-term gains. And associated with this, using a kind of military metaphor, a preoccupation with the primacy of tactics over strategy. That's another way of talking about short-term, long-term, in a way, I think. what Offi argues is that opportunism in this, in the sense of these three attributes, is a pervasive attribute of all working class associations. It's a pervasive tendency in all working class associations. Unions are what they're focusing on, but I think their argument would apply to political parties as well, although they don't themselves apply it to political parties. So we'll use their context. All unions in Western democracies, once those economic systems reach a certain level of stability and development, invariably are opportunist in this way. Well, invariably means they have a strong tendency towards this. There may be brief episodes when they're not, but this is a very powerful and universal tendency. It occurs in Sweden as well as the United States, and France and Germany as well as Italy. And because it's invariant, you don't need nationally specific mechanisms to explain the tendency. There must, and then he argues, there must be something intrinsic in the character of the problem which these organizations face, which leads them in this direction. And he, in particular, is interested in unpacking the structural logic, what he would, I think, refer to as the structural logic, of the problem of collective action that these organizations face. The overall account of his, that he presents in this paper with Wiesenthal, really lays out three, what you might think of as three logics of opportunism. And then he shows how they're connected. There's a structural logic, which is the specific dilemmas that working class associations face in the pursuit of working class goals. That's the structural logic. Then there's what he calls a dynamic logic, or what I call it. This is my reconstruction of his argument. What I would call a dynamic logic, which shows how this structural logic creates a certain dynamic process within working class associations, which he would argue makes opportunism a self-limiting process. Opportunism tends to erode its own conditions of possibility, which means that there will be episodes of militancy and activism that punctuate this tendency towards opportunism. That opportunism isn't a steady state. Opportunism erodes its own conditions of possibility, Offi argues, in ways that generates its own internal opposition. So that opportunistic organizations will tend to produce counter-mobilizations inside of the organization, various kinds of militant resurgences that occur. And then there's an historical logic, which I think, perhaps in an overly optimistic way, imagines that in these cycles of opportunism and militancy that will mark the history of an organization, of a union movement, that there's learning across cycles, so that it doesn't simply doesn't go in a circle, it goes in a spiral, where each new cycle of militancy is informed by the previous episodes of militancy resulting in opportunism, so that progressive possibilities become increasingly likely if you actually believe in this historical logic. I think the structural logic is the most firmly argued for in this paper. The dynamic logic, I think, is interesting, but seems less certain than the structural logic. And the historical logic, that is that there's learning across these cycles of opportunism and militancy, seems the most problematic, because I think the processes of historical forgetting are as powerful as historical memory. And there's no particular reason to imagine that there's a cumulative process across cycles in this process.
But they don't explicitly argue that opportunism is a key strategy for long-term survival, right? I mean, it's not only a preservation of the organization itself. It's a method, a key for the survival of the organization itself. I mean, I couldn't see that in the text, and you did not mention that.
They argue that it is a strategy of reproducing the organization that focuses on the short-run conditions for that stability, but not that it in fact guarantees its long-run survival. No, they don't argue. The opportunism implies that the leadership of unions become preoccupied with short-term survival of the organization, believing that successfully reproducing the organization in the short term does in fact ensure its long-term survival. But the motivations are all, you know, the driving concerns are with the short term. Opportunism isn't a long-term vision by short-term actors. It's a short-term vision by short-term actors. Yeah. So what I want to focus on the structural logic. I think it's the part of their argument that's the most interesting. What the structural logic of working class associations are. And then I'll briefly talk about the dynamic and historical part of the argument as well. Clearly I'm not going to get through this by 12, so this will kind of spill over to the lecture on Wednesday. But I would like to finish both this and Wednesday's topic by the end of Wednesday, because then we can start on the state and politics next week. That's a kind of whole new block in the course. I think the things I've written on the class compromise theme, my ideas about that haven't gone much beyond what I wrote in the material that's been assigned. So I feel in a way it's less crucial that I spend a lot of time in the class further elaborating that. So we may shortchange a little bit the Wednesday topic so that we can get through this. All right. So here's the strategy. It's a pretty cool strategy that Offey argues for. In order to clarify what the distinctive logic of collective action of working class associations are, Offey proposes a comparison between working class and capitalist associations. This breaks with a standard procedure in social movement and collective action theory and sociology, which regards all associations as facing essentially the same problems. You know, so that the issue of free riding problems, for example, is viewed as a common problem that all associations face. Now, Offey isn't denying that all associations face the problem of free riding. That's true for capitalist associations as well as working class associations. But he says the interesting thing is not what all associations face in common, but the class-specific dilemmas that different associations face. And that will help clarify this problem of opportunism. Capitalists and workers face different problems because of two crucial kinds of differences of the circumstances of capitalists and workers. One centers on interests, and another centers on what we can call capacities. Capitalists and workers face very different problems in knowing and discovering what their interests are. That is, problems in eliminating distortions in their own understanding of their interests. Here, what Offey says is that the interests of capitalists are transparent, whereas the interests of workers are not transparent. Capitalists know that their interests as capitalists are in maximizing their rate of profit in a stable way, that their interests are imposed on them by the nature of capitalist competition and accumulation in a capitalist system. That doesn't mean that defines the interests of the persons who are capitalists. Engels was a capitalist, and he had, as a person, interests in the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism because he identified with the working class and had to, through whatever personal process of consciousness formation, had rejected the interests of his class position for the interests of humanity or the working class as guiding his actions. So Engels faced the same problem that workers face in defining what his personal interests were with respect to class conflict, because he did not want to act on his interests as a capitalist. But his interests as a capitalist were clear. Yeah.
But don't capitalists also encounter short and long-term trade-offs in the rate of profit?
Yeah, so capitalists still do have some problems. It's not that from the interests in profits, they immediately know what they should do, because there are often tensions between short-run and long-run. But it's tensions between the short-run and the long-run with respect to a clear goal, which is the stable accumulation of capital through a, if not maximum, at least acceptable rate of profit, and stabilizing the conditions under which that can take place. When one of the criticisms of Offey's argument in this paper is that the interests of capitalists are not transparent, that that's false, that capitalists have wildly heterogeneous interests as capitalists, not just as persons. I don't find that criticism compelling myself. I think that it's a much simpler task for capitalists to know what's in their interests. Even if it's not always simple to know what to do about it. But that the answers to many of those questions have much more of a technical character. They have much more to do with understanding what the technological possibilities are, what the social conditions are which will enable them to instantiate those technical conditions of production, and a whole range of things of that character. They're the kinds of problems which capitalists can leave to experts to act on their behalf. So that while capitalists may not have clear answers to the questions, what should I do given my interests, they have a relatively clear answer to the question, who should I ask, what should I do? They'll ask business experts, economists, analysts of various sorts who will give them good advice about how to pursue their interests, but in which they know what their interests are. Yeah.
Is it the capitalist's interests are transparent to other capitalists, or to everybody, or to the workers, or is it?
It's particularly here. It's the issue is it's transparent to capitalists.
So they share.
Right. So the difference is that for workers, even simply in their role as workers. So we're not asking the question here about the fact that workers may also be Christians and may also be Serbians and may also be something else. We're just saying in their role as workers, as sellers of labor power who don't own the means of production and work in a labor process, there's all sorts of interests at play. There's interests about how hard they work, about the health and safety conditions in the workplace. There's interests about their wages. There's interests about their job security. There's interests that are bound up with the relationship between their work and community, but which are still in their capacity as sellers of labor power, because the reproduction of their labor power takes place in the home, not just in the workplace, through the provision of all sorts of goods within the family. So workers have a very complex array of interests that are in play. They have the interests in the reproduction of their children for the labor market, not just their own labor powers. And, you know, so it's a complicated mix of interests. And how these should be priorities, what weight should be given on them, whether the thing to struggle about is working conditions or health and safety regulations or wages, it's not at all obvious, and there may not even be a right answer. You know, it's not the case that it's a technical question. Workers cannot simply delegate to some labor relations working class intellectual and say, you tell us, should we care more about health and safety conditions or our wages? That's not something which somebody else can do. That's something that you have to discover through some kind of process, but it's a difficult process. So what the key issue here is that capitalists have relatively transparent interests. The interests of workers are not transparent and require a process of dialogue in which workers attempt to forge a consensus through reciprocal communication in order to discover. That's the first part of the equation, analyzing the interests that workers and capitalists face, and therefore that the associations of workers and capitalists face. The second issue is their capacities, their inherent capacities for struggle. What is it that gets mobilized when capitalists struggle against workers versus what gets mobilized when workers struggle against capitalists? Here, what Offey argues is that capitalists, when they struggle against workers, the key thing they have to mobilize are financial resources. Whereas when workers struggle against capitalists, the key thing they have to mobilize is people. He captures this by the contrast between the willingness to pay and the willingness to act. This creates a profound difference in the dilemmas of collective action that people face. Particularly if you're wealthy, devoting part of your resources to collective action on the part of you and your fellow capitalists, as it were, devoting part of your resources to that task, does not represent much of a sacrifice. Now, in a particular case, it might, you know, if you're a capitalist on the verge of bankruptcy, allocating significant resources to a collective action on the part of capitalists might be very costly. But in general, the capitalist class, precisely because of its command over surplus, is able to allocate part of its surplus to the purpose of collective action, its willingness to pay. For workers, what they have to allocate for collective action is always costly, because they're allocating themselves, their own time and effort and energy. And particularly given that they're workers and they have to work and they've got a family life and all that stuff, that's always a sacrifice. It doesn't mean that it's an unwilling sacrifice. It just means that it's a cost. That contrast then provides the central backdrop for Offey's analysis of the dilemmas of collective action that workers and capitalists face. Now, it's a fairly complex analysis if you've read the paper. I think it's a pretty clear paper. It's a well-written piece. You know, unlike some German writers, I think Offey, Offey's a better writer than Habermas is. It goes through it pretty carefully, step by step. I'm not going to retrace all the elements in his analysis here. In my lecture notes, I've gone through at least many of the components fairly carefully. Here, I'd like to just highlight what I think are the really central ideas, the ones that are most important. And in particular, certain formulations that I think are especially nice. So one of Offey's ideas, which I find very compelling, it's at least a compelling expression, he talks about the problem that working class associations face is what he calls the insuperable individuality of workers. I like that expression. What he means is that whatever else happens in a collective action on the part of workers, they remain individual persons. So whereas capitalists can merge units of capital into ever bigger quantities of capital, so they can become richer and richer by merging units of capital into larger masses, and by virtue of that become more powerful. That is, they have more that they can pay through their willingness to pay for collective action. When workers join a collectivity, a collective organization, they don't merge into some super organic individual. They remain separate persons who cooperate collectively for collective action. And this insuperable individuality of workers means that there's this continual problem. It's not a one-shot problem that's solved once you get a worker to join a union. You know, if workers joining unions were like a capitalist acquiring a new firm that merges the capital, then these problems would be much simpler. But workers joining a union doesn't destroy their individuality as a person. They remain separate persons in dialogue with each other, cooperating with each other, but nevertheless, perpetually separate minds and separate agents of choice and action, which means the problem of getting cooperation for collective action is an enduring and always ongoing problem. It may be a successfully solved problem, or more or less successfully, but it doesn't disappear simply with the decision to join. And that is a kind of foundational fact about the dilemma of working class association, this inseparable individuality of workers. In order, therefore, to get working class associations to really function well, the association has to be able to mobilize its members. It's not sufficient to get workers to join unions. It has to sustain a capacity to mobilize workers. And in order to get, and in order to sustain that capacity of the association to mobilize workers, OFFI argues that the associations have to develop a consensus over what the interests of its members are. Collective action occurs when an association calls on its members to engage in a struggle over their interests, and therefore it's crucial that the members of the association share a sense of what is in their interests. This is not a simple problem for working class associations because of the heterogeneity of the interests of its members. The heterogeneity occurs not because you have different kinds of members, but because each member has heterogeneous interests. Workers' associations have to figure out what constitutes the members' interests, and this, Offi argues, can only be done through a dialogic process of communication and interaction. That is, forms of communication that are symmetrical, participatory, and open between leadership and members. This is where the Habermas influence in his argument, I think, is clearest. Habermas's central point, you know, one of his very central ideas, is that certain kinds of problems can only be discovered, certain kinds of answers can only be discovered through open dialogue, what he calls domination-free communication, because that's the only way in which an authentic consensus among the participants in some kind of process can be achieved. That you cannot arrive at a stable solution to a problem simply by being told what's right. People have to discover it through communication. And you can only discover the truth through open communication. So workers, in this view, can only discover what their true interests are, what their robust, real priorities are, through open dialogue in which they listen to each other, modify their own views in light of the arguments and reasons of others, and come to some kind of rough consensus about priorities. Working class associations, therefore, at their core depend upon dialogic processes of communication and interaction. In order to forge the interests that are essential for the solidaristic collective action. That's the starting point for the OFFI dilemma, is that capitalist associations have a simpler task which can be assigned to experts, and therefore capitalist associations can be organized along monologic principles, not dialogic principles of communication, where the experts tell the capitalists what course of action is best for them, whereas working class associations much more deeply rely on dialogic processes of communication. That's the first step of the analysis. That's what he refers to as interest aggregation. The second part of the analysis centers around the problem of the accumulation of power in an association. And here the issue is the one that we've already been talking about, that working class power can't be aggregated in a simple additive way. Atomized, if workers are simply joined a union as atomized individuals who are simply joining the union because of their perception that this is in their own individual self-interest, end of story, that they're just joining the union because they think it's good for them to join the union, that it'll benefit them. If they join the union without conditional altruism, that is, without a regard for the well-being of others, just out of the atomistic motivation of their own interests, then the working class association will not, in fact, have a capacity to mobilize, because the capacity to mobilize depends upon the willingness of individuals to make sacrifices for the welfare of others, not just to make sacrifices for their own individual welfare. That's the whole issue of the free riding problem. If the only reason you're prepared to go on a collective action is because it's good for you, you'll prefer to be a free rider than to participate in the collective action. In order to participate in the collective action, therefore, you have to be willing and have as your priority participation for the well-being of others, not just oneself. And that means that in order for worker power to increase with the increase of members in a union, worker solidarity has to increase with the increase of members of the union. Workers' power fundamentally depends upon solidarity. Capitalist power does not. Capitalists do not have to be really solidaristic with each other in order to have power. They have at their core power simply the acquisition of more capital. That's the core basis of their power. Whereas working class power comes from the transformation of workers as individuals into solidaristic members of a collectivity. I'm looking at the time, whether I want to go into the... Now, I think clarifying this next point, which is on page, it's basically the argument in the second half of page 5. I think this is a sort of 5 to 10 minute clarification rather than a 30 second clarification. So I think this is the best time to stop. We've kind of set up the problem and this notion of the transformation of workers' interests by the organizations of which they're members is really the heart of Bobby's point. So we'll begin midway through page 5.